Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Matthias and I are partners at PsyMed Ventures, a fund investing in psychedelic medicine and mental health. Today's episode is the first in a series that looks at the big wide world of psychedelic research. Stanford University is the latest academic hub to explore unanswered questions in psychedelic science. Yet, unlike Johns Hopkins, NYU, and some other big academic institutions, Stanford doesn't have a dedicated psychedelic research center. Yet. Rather, they're taking a bottoms-up and multidisciplinary approach to studying psychedelics across departments that range from psychiatry to anesthesiology to optogenetics, an emerging science that uses light to control the activity of neurons. So, what psychedelic discoveries has Stanford made so far? In this three-part series, we chat with three Stanford researchers, Rob Malenka, Boris Heifetz, and Carolyn Rodriguez. They share with us their recent findings from studies. We nerd out about their study designs, and they'll give us a look at areas they're researching next. In this episode, we'll talk with Rob Malenka. The man wears many hats at Stanford. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences, the director of the Nancy Pritzker Laboratory, deputy director of the Wu Tsai Neurosciences Institute, and associate chair for the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. Rob has been at Stanford for over 20 years, and he is the glue that keeps the university's psychedelic research together. With a special view into the many experiments going on right now, he shares his perspective about what makes Stanford's approach to studying psychedelic science unique. Rob also has experience founding companies, so he'll provide insight into what it takes to commercialize academic research. Here's part one of our three-part series looking at Stanford's psychedelic research with Rob Malenka.
Matthias will start off the interview.
Rob, welcome to Business Trip. Can you start by introducing yourself and sharing a little bit more about what you do in the psychedelic medicine field?
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure and fun to be here. I'm Rob Malenka. I'm a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University. Historically, I am a clinically trained psychiatrist who has been running a preclinical neuroscience research lab for over 30 years now. And I became very interested in studying the effects and mechanisms of actions of various psychoactive drugs, including psychedelics. I've been interested for 40 years. I've actually started really studying them in my lab with some collaborators at Stanford approximately maybe 10, 12 years ago. And because I'm also a psychiatrist, even though I don't see clients or patients anymore, I'm really excited about, in my own lab, understanding how psychedelics work in the context of their therapeutic potential, and working with colleagues here at Stanford who do human subjects research in that domain. I'm also one of the founders and deputy directors of the Wu Tsai Neurosciences Institute here at Stanford, which is a university-wide multidisciplinary institute that supports all different types of neuroscience research, including computational approaches and neuroengineering approaches. And then I also have some entrepreneurial activities where I'm the founder of a biotech, which currently is not focused on psychedelics. And I'm also on the advisory board of a few companies, two of which are in the psychedelic space.
So you've been interested in psychedelic therapeutics for quite some time. But in the past few years, I would say Stanford has increased its focus on psychedelic science. Why did that happen?
I think it happened for the same reason it's happening throughout the country and throughout the world. This class of substances has become de-demonized. They've been legitimized as the object of important scientific investigation. To toot my own horn, I'd like to think I contributed to that very slightly by 4 years ago, I was writing a commentary in a very prominent scientific journal about the importance of studying MDMA as a probe for very powerful and important effects on brain function in the social domains. And to give credit where credit's due, it's also the pioneers in this field, like Roland Griffiths and all of the efforts of MAPS and Rick Doblin, showing that these substances do have therapeutic potential. On the preclinical scientific side, it was people like me and a colleague named Boris Heifetz interested in this topic with some colleagues who do human subjects research, like Tricia Supes, Leanne Williams. So it's just gelled where, to be honest, we all came out of the closet. I think many of us had all had this interest, given that I am the senior member of the community here, and I am a child of the 60s and 70s. The experience of using these drugs is one of the reasons I became a neuroscientist and one of the reasons I became a psychiatrist. The fascination with these drugs, how does it have such a powerful effect on my experiences in both in the environment and with other people? How can a drug do that? It's just this combination of events. It's hard to say one single event, but well-respected academic institutions are now saying this is an exciting area that we want to embrace and support. And that didn't start happening till 7 to 10 years ago.
This idea of coming out of the closet, I read many times that you were interested or you do a lot of preclinical work in neuroplasticity. And maybe like neuroplasticity is a closeted way for someone to say that they're interested in psychedelics. So I like that.
Yeah, I like that way of framing it. As you point out, my lab has been focused, it's not great when you're my age to say for over 30 years, on brain plasticity mechanisms. And I've always thought drugs like psychedelics were powerful probes of those mechanisms. How is it that our brain changes, both in adaptive, productive ways and also in pathological ways? So I like the way you framed it. It was my way. It was working on plasticity mechanisms was a highly legitimate topic. Working on psychedelics, especially back when I started my career in the 80s and 90s, I have to be honest, it would not have probably been good for my career to have a major focus on elucidating the mechanisms of actions of drugs like MDMA or psilocybin or LSD. Maybe I could have done it, but it would have been a very challenging endeavor to build a successful academic career. And it's very exciting for somebody like me who's been interested in the topic. Actually, I'm embarrassed to say this, for 45 or 50 years to finally come out of the closet, just be able to say, and actually, and be more forceful in articulating the importance of the topic and why people should be studying how these drugs work at many different levels.
So fascinating. Going back to the efforts that Stanford has on psychedelic science, how are those efforts organized? Is there a physical center where all this happens? Is it like a different department? Or how do you think of the efforts that Stanford has around psychedelic science?
The truth is that they've evolved organically, which is very common at many academic institutions. You just start talking to colleagues about, you know, what are you working on? What are you excited about? You start finding out, oh, I didn't realize you were interested in this topic. So, you know, I was one of those people, my colleague, Boris Heifetz, who's an MD, PhD anesthesiologist. And then I want to give a lot of credit to a psychiatry resident that you guys may know, Gianni Glick. Gianni showed up just 4 years ago, but he's very knowledgeable about the potential clinical use of these substances, the history of their use. And he had enormous energy where almost single-handedly he organized a course. He started contacting people like me that he had heard had an interest. So right now, it's a little bit more organized than it was 5, 6, 7 years ago, where we interact in both informally about the topics we're interested in. We are working on trying to raise funds for establishing a, in quotes, a named center. That is actually a challenging endeavor at institutions like Stanford. But that effort, which brought many of us together, has coalesced the types of efforts we're trying to do. It turns out through traditional grant structures, there's a group of us who are part of what's known as a program project that we received from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. It sort of evolved organically. There's not a funded named center, but there's a consortium of faculty, many but not all of which are in the Department of Psychiatry, who are working together to advance research and understanding of mechanism of action and therapeutic potential. Oh, and I forgot, I just met another wonderful addition to our faculty, and I think you know Christian Greer. He's joined the faculty here in, I think it's the Department of American Studies, and he's a real expert on the history of psychedelic drug use, both among indigenous cultures, but also within the United States. So he approaches the topic from a sociocultural and historical perspective.
Can you provide a rundown of some of the researchers that are studying psychedelics and a snippet of what it is that they're studying?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. And it's quite a number. And just to name a few of them, let me start with a colleague by the name of Nolan Williams. He's an associate professor in psychiatry. His most recent innovation and discovery has to do with a novel methodology for using transmagnetic stimulation as a therapeutic tool for the treatment of depression. But he's also very interested in the therapeutic potential of psychedelics. And he actually teamed up with a philanthropic organization called VETS. This is an organization that sends individuals who served in special ops, Navy SEALs, Green Berets, who come back to our country with traumatic brain injury, with post-traumatic stress disorder, and these individuals. And it's an organization founded and run by Amber and Marcus Capone, an amazing couple who deserves enormous credit for their efforts. And these individuals, these vets, go to Mexico and they receive Ibogaine as a therapeutic treatment. And Nolan has done a study where he did an extensive workup of some of these individuals before they went to Mexico, including symptom scales on how severe their cognitive disability was, their anxiety, their depression, their PTSD symptoms. He did brain scans. Then these individuals went to Mexico. Then they came back and they're being evaluated a week, a month, 3 months, 6 months after the Ibogaine treatment. And in an open label study, he's done 30 subjects. The results are remarkable, really, really exciting in how efficacious the Ibogaine seems to be. So that's Nolan Williams. I have a colleague named Leanne Williams, who runs the Center for Precision Mental Health here at Stanford. And her primary methodology is human brain imaging, something called functional magnetic resonance imaging. So she's trying to peer into the brain, looking at network activity in the brain. And she's doing studies on MDMA and how that affects network activity in human subjects. There's Tricia Supps. She's a clinical trialist who is conducting either one or several trials on the potential clinical utility of psilocybin in the treatments of veterans. She's a professor of psychiatry whose primary appointment is at the Palo Alto VA Medical Center. So a lot of her studies are being done on veterans with PTSD or severe treatment-resistant depression. She's doing a psilocybin trial. I think she's also doing an MDMA trial. There's a colleague in the psychology department, Brian Knudsen, who's also a brain imager using functional magnetic resonance imaging. He's collaborating with Leanne Williams, looking at how ketamine and MDMA changes network activity in human subjects. There's my colleague, Carl Dizeroff, who's a very famous, preeminent neuroscientist who has published some important work on ketamine, which I really don't think is a classic psychedelic. And he's now become very interested in studying drugs like MDMA or DMT. And he is both studying them in mouse models where he's developed very sophisticated techniques where with cellular resolution, he can look at brain-wide network activity in the cerebral cortex and how these substances like DMT change that network activity in mice. He's also developed approaches in collaboration with neurosurgeons where under appropriate ethical constraints in patients who are undergoing surgeries to monitor their epilepsy using electrodes implanted throughout their brain, giving these subjects while they're in the hospital certain psychoactive substances. He's done this with ketamine so far, but he's interested in expanding that to other types of substances, perhaps something like DMT, because it's rapid on, rapid off, to actually use electrophysiological measurements in human subjects and use that as a bridge to the findings we were able to get in animal subjects like mice, where we're able to more directly image and intervene and interrogate neural activity. I'm almost done, but you can see there's a lot of us here. As I think I mentioned Gianni Glick earlier, Gianni is a fourth-year psychiatry resident with enormous knowledge about the history of psychedelic use. He founded the Stanford Psychedelic Science Group, where he's organized a very popular course called the Introduction to Psychedelic Medicine. And then I will mention my close collaborator, Boris Heifetz, who was a postdoc with me, where we worked on MDMA together, trying to elucidate the kind of molecular, synaptic, and circuit actions of MDMA in mice that are responsible for its very powerful pro-social effects. And now Boris is an assistant professor in the anesthesia department because he's an anesthesiologist. And he's one of the few people, I think, in the world that has a leg in the preclinical neuroscience research world, primarily using animal species like mice to really probe mechanisms of psychedelic drug action, but he also has a very active clinical research program. And then finally, the last person I'll mention is Carolyn Rodriguez, who's another colleague in the psychiatry department, who is doing a trial of the efficacy of MDMA in OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, has done some clinical trial work related to ketamine in addition. And I'm sure I've forgotten a few of my colleagues, and I apologize, but I think I've given you quite a number. So probably more than you needed to know.
That's great. So you've been at Stanford for over 20 years. I think you could help us figure out what is unique about Stanford's approach to psychedelic science, in which way Stanford brings something to the table that no one else could bring.
I think I'll emphasize two aspects of what makes Stanford a little bit special. One is it is the center and a pioneer in development of very novel methodologies that can be applied to neuroscience research, including psychedelic science research. The epitome of this is my close friend and colleague, Carl Dizeroff, who invented a methodology called optogenetics, which is a methodology where you can use molecular genetic approaches to express foreign proteins in the brain of animals. And it's actually beginning to be done in human subjects. And then you use light to activate or inhibit the neural activity of specific nerve cells or neurons in the brain in ways that allow you to do manipulations of neural activity in ways that were unimaginable. He also is a pioneer in developing very novel imaging methodologies where you can image broad areas of the mammalian brain and look at network activity with cellular resolution in ways that were unimaginable. And then what we like to argue, what makes Stanford really special, is everybody's on one campus. The medical school's on the same campus as the Department of Biology, the School of Engineering, the computer scientist. And so we have a history and an ease of doing very collaborative and interdisciplinary work. And that's especially important when you're trying to build bridges between the more mechanistically driven preclinical neuroscience research that I believe is of real importance for advancing psychedelic science, which really involves studying animals, studying non-human subjects like mice, even more primitive organisms like zebrafish or mice or non-human primates, and building bridges between that type of research and people who do human subjects research, both mechanistic human subjects research, because while all of us are most interested in how these substances influence human brain function, human thought and feelings and cognition and behavior, if you want to understand the mechanisms of that, it's really advantageous to be able to go back and forth between research in human subjects and more mechanistic research in animal subjects. And I think that's what we have really developed and are evolving here at Stanford in ways that I haven't seen other places quite been able to do. And truth be told, my hope is for the psychedelic science community here at Stanford, I hope we can start interesting our engineering colleagues, our chemical biology colleagues, our colleagues who take computational approaches. Because as we get more sophisticated in trying to understand how these drugs work in the brain, in the ways I was alluding to earlier about what if when it becomes possible to record the activity from thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of individual neurons in the brain before that brain is exposed to psilocybin or LSD and after, to really understand what's going on, again, mechanistically, it's going to be really advantageous to get our colleagues who are very sophisticated theoreticians. A lot of them are used to be physicists who are taking computational approaches. So as always, guys, I'm talking way too much. I'm very loquacious. But as you can tell, I'm a big fan of Stanford. I'm a very passionate advocate for the types of approaches we're taking here.
I guess that another thing that's unique about Stanford, obviously it's not the only place where this happens, but it's very pervasive in Stanford, is the ability of researchers and academics to spin out companies. And Stanford is well known for that and incentivizes it. And things like technology transfer office, everything's structured in a way that removes the friction out of spinning out companies. Going to the psychedelic science efforts that Stanford is doing, and this is maybe a little bit of predicting the future, but what would you say are the efforts, studies, and directions that are most likely to be commercialized based on the studies that you're currently running?
That's a really good question. Truth be told, Boris and I tried to start a little company based on some of our MDMA findings. We failed, but a company I advise called MindMed is pursuing one angle, which is actually pursuing a specific enantiomer of MDMA, which is our MDMA, for a variety of reasons. I'm working with my colleagues, Norlin Williams, Alan Schatzberg, who's a professor of psychiatry, I forgot to mention, a very leading psychopharmacologist in this country, on a company that's going to perhaps pursue some of Nolan's findings with ibogaine. It's a little more complicated than that. There's enormous excitement in the community about this. There's how many different psychedelic companies are there? Several that are trying to generate novel compounds where they can get patents around composition of matter based on the structure of LSD or psilocybin or ibogaine to see whether they can tweak the molecules we all know. None of that, to my knowledge, is going on at Stanford, but I think there's a lot of potential for that to happen because there's a whole program here called ChemH, which is basically a chemical biology program, where the goal of which is to bring together chemists, biomedical researchers, and biologists to develop very novel small molecules and use chemistry to advance biology. This is an effort headed by Carolyn Bertozzi, who recently won the Nobel Prize a year or two ago. But truth be told, to my knowledge, those of us interested in psychedelics have not yet hooked up with that community. If you want to broaden your question, there are colleagues here at Stanford working on very novel drug delivery methodologies. So right now, when any individual takes a psychedelic, usually they swallow it, maybe they'll smoke it, maybe they'll snort it through their nose. But there are people at Stanford working on very sophisticated ways of delivering psychoactive substances to the brain. There's a colleague who's developing really cool techniques where you might be able to deliver a drug only to one part of your brain, but not another. And think about that. That's pretty cool because every drug, even psychedelics, they have positive effects, but they can have negative effects. And wouldn't it be cool if we can figure out where in the brain a drug like a psychedelic is working to benefit that individual, and where in the brain maybe that drug has a higher likelihood of having a bad effect? And then obviously, if you're thinking of using these kinds of substances therapeutically, you want to deliver it to the therapeutic part of the brain and avoid delivering it to the... And so there are those kinds of possibilities. And then one thing I'm really interested in is none of this is happening yet. You know, I'm really interested in pursuing the possibility of combining different therapeutic modalities because none of us know. We're all very excited about the therapeutic potential of drugs like MDMA and psilocybin, to pick the obvious ones. But none of us know. It's too early to know how long their potential therapeutic effects may last. Do they last 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 years, forever? Who knows? And there may be advantages to using psychedelic type drugs as therapies and in combining them with other types of therapeutic approaches, such as transmagnetic stimulation. Who knows? Maybe combined, you'll get really longer lasting therapeutic effects. This is a little bit science fiction. This is not happening yet, but one can imagine. So I have been in the medical business for over 40 years. I would like you guys to be a little cautious in your audience to really understand how things work. You got to do well-controlled, scientifically rigorous clinical studies, because in part because the brain is very powerful even without drugs, even without psychedelics. The expectancy and what you hope will happen and your expectancy of therapeutic benefit or lack thereof can actually have an enormous effect on whether you get a therapeutic benefit or not. And because I am an academic and I like to believe I'm a pretty rigorous scientist, I really want this field to develop in a way where we do, because psychedelics are a legitimate object of scientific research, we value rigorous scientific research in the field, and we want to really know what's really working, what really isn't, and what ends up just being, yeah, it was nice, it was anecdotal, it worked in these few patients, but in fact, when you do a careful study, you don't see effects, or you do see effects. And that's really important societally, because even if you're a believer that these substances will have, you have to convince funding agencies. You have to convince health insurance companies. Otherwise, as therapeutics, these substances will only be available to the rich and the connected. And I don't think any of us want that.
When you mentioned this idea of expectancy, I was thinking we want cheap placebos. We don't want expensive placebos. Placebo's good. It's great. Yeah. But let's not make people pay a lot of money for placebo.
You nailed it, as always. Yeah, so I agree with that.
I want to dig a little deeper into the commercialization. So I would think that there are a couple of things that Stanford is doing that are more likely to derive into something that's commercialized or something that's in the clinic. The first one's around this idea of a hemp program, the mechanistic understanding, both in animal models, but also in humans, that you're developing around the classic psychedelics will probably inform the creation of new chemical entities. And so that's one part, because one of the challenges I would pose with the current studies that are happening around psychedelics is IP. And as you mentioned, the idea that biopharma prioritizes NCEs and like very clear IP. And so on one side, the mechanistic understanding, it's great for the future. On the other side, the fact that so many of the studies are happening with generic drugs makes things a little bit harder from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, so I have two responses. I completely agree with what you're saying, that it's going to be really important for the field, especially in terms of commercialization and entrepreneurship, for companies to develop NCEs around which you can get patent protection and build a company. Also, because they may, again, have better therapeutic potential, fewer side effects. I wish I could say that activity was going on currently at Stanford. If it is, unfortunately, I'm unaware of it. I do think Stanford is the perfect place for that to happen, in part, as I alluded to earlier, because we have a whole program called ChemH, which is basically a chemical biology program. It's just, to my knowledge, I haven't reached out to my colleagues in that department. But again, that's where, if I can advertise Stanford, if we could raise some money, that provides capital for providing small grants to faculty. Because being an academic, even at a place like Stanford, all of the individual faculty, we're all running small businesses. We have to raise money to do the experiments in our labs. We have to pay personnel, we have to pay for supplies, and we have to generate those funds.
Yeah, so two things come to mind. One is most of the episodes that we record are featuring companies or different folks that are more on the business side. And so when we thought about this episode, it's exactly for the reason you just mentioned. The time frames and the kind of like longevity of university is so much longer. And so what you said of the mechanistic understanding that you're having today, which will potentially derive in NCEs, and that being done by the CHEM program that Stanford has, that takes so many years. And companies most times can't afford to do that. So that is, feels like that's such a good place for academia. And that's why the transition is sometimes academia moves to companies. And then running a business that most researchers and faculty have at Stanford and other universities, we can attest to that. 66% of our portfolio companies from our fund one, the fund that we're currently investing from, are academic spinouts. And all the folks that came up with the research that then span out into the company, in one way or another, they're involved, and sometimes as even CEOs, and it's just inspiring. They're like, you would think that they're natural business people, but that's not really true. It's that they learned a lot about running a company through their roles running labs or departments at universities.
I completely agree with you, and I'm going to rip off how you articulate it so eloquently, the importance of why having Psychedelic Science Center at Stanford is important. A lot of these companies are not going to make it for the exact reason you said. They're under pressure to raise funds. Things don't work out. They can't afford to take a long view. Whereas universities, especially universities like Stanford, we know Stanford is going to be around for probably a few more centuries, assuming the Earth is still around and the human species is around. And that's why I would argue investments, whether it's philanthropic or in university-based psychedelic centers, is important. I mean, Matthias, you articulated it beautifully, because we have a longer view. The pressure we have is generating knowledge. And yeah, and then to raise money so we can generate more knowledge. But it's not to generate profits. It's not to have a product that we're going to sell in 5 to 12 years to make our VC investors 5 to 50x return on their investment. And I like the way you think. If we are convinced that this topic is of sufficient importance for the human species, both the therapeutic potential, the potential for eventually, under appropriate ethical circumstances, using these substances to probe the power of the human brain and what it's capable of, we need to take a long view, because that's not going to happen in 3 years or 5 years or 8 years. Again, having been an academic scientist, if I go back to when I started my graduate school in med school, unfortunately, for 45 years, it's weird. I mean, a lot of progress has happened in certain areas, and in other areas, progress is glacial. And I think psychedelic science, it's going to have both of those components. There's going to be some exciting new stuff happening, but we need a decades-long commitment. So thank you for giving me those ideas.
One more question related to what you were talking about with regards to commercializing research. You touched on a company that you started with Boris around MDMA and it failed. Can you tell us a story about what happened?
I'm trying to think. This is several years ago. We had ideas. We were approached by some very young entrepreneurs who I liked enormously. These guys were great. They were young. They were energetic. They were interested in this space. They were interested in starting some sort of drug company related to not only psychedelics, but CNS disorders, more with a focus on not neurodegenerative disorders, not like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, but more disorders that psychiatrists deal with, like depression or addiction, with an interest in the potential of psychedelics. They somehow found me. I liked them a lot. I started brainstorming with them about potential ideas. And one idea, God, I guess I can be honest here, was around pursuing analogs of MDMA and perhaps even enantiomers of MDMA. All I'll say is just things didn't happen. They didn't move efficiently. We had lots of discussions, lots of meetings. We actually incorporated, but it just, I didn't have time to push the ideas forward in a meaningful way, because I am a full-time academic. And my young entrepreneurial colleagues, they talked a great game. I liked them enormously. They were smart as hell. One of them had been a successful investor in other areas. But to be honest, they weren't putting money forward. I naively thought the individual who actually had an investment fund and had made successful investments previously, I naively thought he was going to be writing checks. And it turns out, well, he wasn't quite as willing to write checks to the degree I thought he was. And then, so enough said, this was several years ago now. But it was a fun experience. And as you guys know, as investors, things like this happen. I moved on. I learned a lot.
What is the lesson learned?
The lesson learned is, how to say this nicely, in the business entrepreneurial world, just like in the academic world and just like in the car mechanic world, there are people who are BS artists and there are people who, when they say they're going to do something, they do it and they're action oriented. And then there are people who are really good talking the talk, but not walking the walk. And I'm a very action-oriented individual. I believe when somebody says they're going to do something, they're actually going to do it. And sometimes that just isn't the case. So I think my lesson is I am working on another little company with some colleagues I mentioned. I need to not be charmed by intelligence and good looks. I need to be a little more cautious in when somebody says they're going to do something, pushing back a little bit harder on. But the good news is I learned a lot. I had a lot of fun conversations with my younger colleagues. I wish them well. If they're listening to this, hey, guys, you can email me. I'm not pissed off anymore. I've let go of my anger and I've moved on quickly. Because my strength and my weakness is I am historically and continue to be an ivory tower academic. I hope to be a successful entrepreneur. Like I said, the company I started with a colleague named Carl Dizeroth and Carolee Nikolic is doing pretty well. It's called MapLight Therapeutics. It's not a psychedelic company. But my goal is, for me selfishly, is not to make money for myself. It's to have impact on areas I care about. And the area I care about, in all seriousness, is psychiatry and developing better treatments for people with severe mental illnesses. And if I can do that, and I, you know, in any way I can, man, that will make me very contented and happy. And I'm doing some entrepreneurship because I think that is one way I can do it. I also do stuff in the philanthropic world. And obviously the goal is to build bridges between philanthropy and entrepreneurship and commercialization and developing, whether they're drugs or whether they're therapies, to increase empathy and compassion in our world. That's why I'm interested in MDMA.
Excellent.
Okay, Rob, the last section of the interview is usually a rapid-fire set of questions.
All right, all right.
What are you the most excited about in psychiatry? And this doesn't need to be only about psychedelics.
I'm excited in psychiatry about the potential of psychedelics as therapeutic agents. I'm excited by the fact that in academia, we can now study these agents and be out of the closet and use the most rigorous and sophisticated and creative approaches. I'm excited by the potential of what we term neuromodulation approaches. This includes transmagnetic stimulation, focused ultrasound, in under certain circumstances, deep brain stimulation. I'm excited about the ability, because of new methodologies, both in the preclinical animal world and the human subjects research world, I'm excited about the ability to build bridges between the mechanistically driven preclinical neuroscience world and individuals who study human subjects. And I think that's going to be the future of successful academic psychiatry research.
Do you trust animal models in psychedelics?
I don't like the question of trust. It is what it is. Do I believe in evolution? Yes. So do I believe that some of the molecular targets of psychedelics in animal models like mice are going to be the same or very similar to the molecular targets that these drugs act on in human subjects? Yes. And because of that, I think we can gain important mechanistic insight by using animal models, even as primitive as zebrafish, but certainly as rodents. But of course, I am not naive that everything we see in a mouse is going to immediately translate in how these drugs work in human subjects. That's why I think it's really important to have communication between the different types of research and be testing of the finding I may get in a mouse, does it actually have applicability to what happens in a human brain and vice versa? If one of my colleagues has some glimpse of some novel brain area that these drugs are acting on, can I test that in a mouse model? So I don't like the term trust. I think it is, you have to accept the strengths and limitations of any species you're studying and any experimental approach you're using.
How much do you spend on housing mice per year?
So when you say housing, what that means is we keep our mice in cages in a temperature-controlled, light-controlled room. And amazingly at Stanford, I spend $400,000 to $600,000 a year. So $30,000 to $50,000 a month to have my mice housed in a small room in the animal care facility here at Stanford.
Can you share some other uses for psychedelics that are not therapeutic that are interesting to you?
I want to be very cautious here. As a medical professional and a licensed physician in the state of California and a law-abiding citizen, I do not condone the use of any Schedule I substance that is not under an IRB-approved clinical trial. If you're asking me, do I think these drugs can be studied to probe important human experiences? I think I mentioned this earlier. I am most fascinated by MDMA and the effects it has on human social interactions, because I think it very well may enhance the ability of individuals to have, for lack of a better term, empathy, without getting into arguments about what empathy means. And I think that's an amazing property of MDMA and one I am really fascinated by that I think should be studied. And in that context, I think MDMA could be used in political negotiations between warring parties. That I'm actually being willing to go on the record. I see no harm being done and perhaps some potential good being done. I think that would be a wonderful use of MDMA. In terms of other substances, again, I have to be cautious because of the role I play here at Stanford. I think under appropriate guidance and circumstances, one's experience with classic hallucinogens can be very meaningful and powerful. So I am an advocate of exploring their use in end-of-life situations, in individuals facing existential issues and crises. I just have to emphasize that I think it's really important that be done with appropriate ethical considerations and appropriate guidance by very well-trained psychotherapists or professionals, because I'm not quite as evangelical as some people, because I have seen people have bad experiences with these substances. I have seen it. And one can argue maybe eventually there was some good from that experience, but during the experience, it was not good. And that's my one concern as a medical profession. Because remember, in all of the clinical trials, these subjects are very carefully screened. And it is not the case that every person in our society should take these substances. That's just, in my view, simply not true. There are people who should not take them. Bad things are going to happen if certain individuals take them.
So last question. Assuming you are in a place where adult use of psychedelic medicines is permitted, it's legal, and folks are properly screened, right? So those are the assumptions. Which scientist, dead or alive, would you like to do psychedelics with?
That is a great question. Oh, my God, there are so many. Obviously, I would love to do it with Sigmund Freud. In his day, I'd love to do it with Carl Jung. I'm saying probably the obvious ones. I'd love to do it with Charles Darwin. Oh, Wallace. Darwin's the other guy who generated the theory of evolution. George Wallace. So there's Freud, Jung, Darwin, and George Wallace, because those guys are incredibly creative, innovative thinkers. And I'd love to see what their brains are capable of. I'm not mentioning physicists. My father was a physicist, because that's a world so far beyond my intelligence. I have no idea what an Einstein would be like, because I still don't understand the theory of relativity. And I got an A in physics in college, but I still don't understand it. So I'm not mentioning mathematicians and physicists. Because of my background, I'm a biologist, I'm a psychiatrist, so I'm naming the obvious people.
Rob, not only this has been very informative, it's also been super entertaining. So thank you for spending a lot of time with us, and thank you for the work that you're doing at Stanford.
No, thank you for having me. It's a lot of fun talking to you both, and I'm really pleased young, energetic, passionate individuals like yourself a part of this world. You give me hope. You give me hope.
This is Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. Tune in to part two of our three-part series about Stanford's psychedelic research, where we chat with Boris Heifetz, a neuroscientist and anesthesiologist who recently conducted a placebo-controlled study to evaluate the effect of ketamine on depressed patients who are under anesthesia. He'll discuss his findings and lots more in the episode. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMedVentures. And if you're building a company in frontier mental health, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Our producer and editor is Jonathan Davis, with production coordination from Caitlin Nair. Sound design and engineering came from Nico Ray. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time.